On the program today, the trade war as seen from Shanghai. A reminder that a growing economy is not always a good thing. And how do airlines decide on those ticket prices anyway? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, the 8th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Out of Beijing today comes this news. The trade talks going on over there have been extended for a third day. A Chinese official described them as constructive. President Trump took time out from working on the speech he's going to give tonight to tweet that negotiations, quote, were going very well. All positive signs for that economy, this economy, and the global economy, and the markets took them as such. We, though, wanted to get a sense of how the negotiations are playing with the Chinese public. So we got Marketplace's Jennifer Pak on the phone from Shanghai. Hey.
Hey, Kai.
So, look, what's the vibe over there about these trade talks? Because while there is lots of news over here, business and economic news is largely about these talks and what's going to happen. What's the sense out there, you know, on the streets of Shanghai?
I would say not many people are talking about it, and that's down to two things. One, there's a heavy level of censorship about the topic here in China. But secondly, the tariffs, the counter tariffs that China has imposed on American products, they're not really hitting the pockets of consumers. So when you're talking about American beef, whiskey, or even seafood being hit with 10 or 25% additional tariffs, well, those items are not essential in the daily lives of Chinese people. They're being sold at premium supermarkets here at fancy malls. So they can either go without, or if they really, really want a good American steak, sometimes they're not going to care about a 10 or 25% additional tariff on them. So, you know, what people here are really talking about, retirement savings, medical care, and also housing prices.
Wow. Kind of like here. So Kevin Hassett, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors of the White House, said the other day that he really thinks this trade war, such as it is hurting the Chinese economy. And that's going to force Xi Jinping basically to the negotiating table. What's your sense?
Well, that's certainly a nice narrative, but that's not really true. You know, China's economy is still growing, just not as fast as it used to be. And that's by design. Chinese leaders have said that the economy needs to slow down and have more quality growth. And it's been happening for the last few years. So people who are in the manufacturing sector, they've been feeling it. They're talking about stricter environmental controls. They've been forced to move into industrial zones. Their costs have gone up. But for the general population in China, or even in the streets of Shanghai, which is a much wealthier city, people are not really aware of it. You know, the younger generation, a lot of them are saying, if I see something, I want it, it's within my budget, I'm going to buy it. They're not really holding back at all. And you know, we've been talking about Apple sales, right? That's been going down in China. You can't really see it on the streets. And actually, the Apple store during work hours on a weekday, it was still pretty packed.
Jennifer Pak in Shanghai. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks, Kai.
There is a brand new help wanted sign up at the World Bank. Jim Yong Kim, who became president of the World Bank back in 2012, announced yesterday he is stepping down at the end of the month, 3 years before his term is set to expire. So it was kind of a surprise. The World Bank is traditionally led by an American. The International Monetary Fund goes to the Europeans. Currently, it's Christine Lagarde of France. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains how that convention came to be, whether it's going to hold this time, and just why it matters.
Both the World Bank and the IMF were created after the Second World War. The World Bank does, well, lots of things, but primarily it lends to poor and middle-income countries, often for development projects in healthcare or infrastructure, things like that. The IMF also lends to countries, but when they're in crisis. It's sometimes called the lender of last resort. Jacob Kierkegaard is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says the fact that the U.S. leads one, Europeans the other.
It is essentially a function of what the world looked like when the IMF and the World Bank were set up in the years after World War II. The world looks obviously very different.
This is the moment where change might happen.
Meg Lunsager, currently at the Wilson Center, formerly at the IMF, says no matter who heads these organizations, the U.S. is still going to be very influential. But there's a push for other countries to have a turn at the helm.
So in part, it's up to the administration. If they want to hang on to this role, they need to nominate a really terrific person. that would garner support broadly around the world.
In Africa, Asia, and Latin America, as well as in places like Europe, Japan, and Canada. Tom Boyke with the Council on Foreign Relations.
There's competition for the bank. China relatively recently started an infrastructure bank. Private capital is playing a larger role. The bank is in a crowded space now, so it does have a need to continue to reinvent itself so that it's relevant and useful in this changed environment.
He says for the bank to be effective, the next leader will have to secure a broad global base of support. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
As I said, Wall Street and global markets were quite pleased. Thank you very much with the way the trade news seems to be shaping up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The president's going to be on TV tonight, as I said. Radio 2, by the way, in a more formal setting than he is usually on the air, trying to make his case for the border wall that is the central sticking point in the shutdown that has kept 800,000 federal workers either furloughed or working without pay for the past 18 days. This coming Friday is going to be the first missed payday for people like Brian Turner. He works for TSA at the Philadelphia International Airport, which means he is considered essential, which means he still has to go to work and still isn't getting paid. When we called, he had just finished his shift.
You start prioritizing what you need to use your money with. For instance, you know, we have credit card payments. Well, food is more important.
Sonny Blaylock's got the same problem.
I haven't been to work since December 22nd.
She designs e-learning apps for the Foreign Service Institute.
You know, we just got braces for our daughter, which I had planned on and put money aside on my flexible spending account, which didn't come through because I'm not employed.
Her husband is a Foreign Service officer. He has been designated essential, so he's working and not getting paid. Sonny says in their neighborhood, just outside Washington, everybody is feeling the shutdown.
For example, there's one lady who is complaining. She's a dog walker, and now she doesn't have any dogs to walk because everyone's now furloughed and at home, so she's lost her business.
Dion Goetz is a federal contractor. She runs the employee cafeteria in the Smithsonian, which is closed, so her food service business is closed as well, which means Dion and her two employees are also out of work. She is just trying to live leaner.
I'm trying to redo leftovers and make it a good meal. You know, so it's a lot of things that I'm very conscious of.
Garrett Johnson's the manager of Spa Logic Salon and Spa, also in Washington, where there is, he says, a distinct lack of foot traffic.
Between Christmas and New Year's is normally a little bit slow anyway, but usually right after it picks right up, and it didn't. And just, it's not just the business here. There's nobody out on, not nobody, but very few people out on the street coming into work in the morning. Traffic is much lighter.
So he did what businesses do when they need to get people in the door.
What we're offering is 20% off anyone that can show us government ID, 20% off any of the services we offer.
A shutdown special, if you will. President Trump on the air tonight, 9 o'clock Eastern. Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, the latest on the speech and the wall and the shutdown. Also, the latest on consumer debt in this economy, late as we are in this business cycle. We're going to do a couple of stories now about the downside of an up economy. There was a report out today from the economic research firm Rhodium Group about carbon dioxide emissions in the United States, a greenhouse gas, as you know. Those emissions were up sharply last year, the second largest CO2 increase we've seen in 20 years, which isn't great news on its face. But also, it had looked for a while that we could have a growing economy without increasing pollution. Doesn't look that way anymore, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains.
For centuries, the more the world's economies grew, the more they polluted the atmosphere. The link was severed for about a decade, starting in 2005.
Gernot Wagner is a research associate and lecturer at Harvard. Part of this was the recession, but a big part was moving away from coal and towards wind, solar, and natural gas.
That's the largest driver of U.S. reductions over the past 10 years or so.
Nate Aden is a senior fellow at the World Resources Institute. Natural gas is cleaner than coal, but it still pollutes. And Aden says we may have reached the limit of what it can do. Last year, U.S. carbon emissions rose 3.4%, according to the Rhodium Group.
A booming economy contributed to an increase in emissions.
Robert Jackson is a professor at Stanford. We are back, for now, to the traditional relationship between growth and pollution. But that relationship is not destiny.
There are 20 countries or more around the world that have seen their economies grow over the last decade and seen their CO2 emissions decline.
In fact, emissions are down 10% in the U.S. compared to 2007. But he says further progress isn't possible without policy promoting cleaner technology. Trevor Hauser is with the Rhodium Group and co-authored the report showing rising emissions.
It's not the rollback in policies that the Trump administration has adopted so much as the absence of new policy action.
Hauser says this year, as the economy cools, emissions could be flat or even decline, but not nearly fast enough to have a meaningful impact on climate change. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Story two in our Be Careful What You Wish For block is from Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer. The economy is good, as we've been reporting. It is strong and it is stable. But there is a new report that says consumer debt, bigger piles of it, that is owed to less strongly regulated financial institutions, could be a sign of economic problems ahead. Here's Nancy.
Auto loan debt is up 76% since 2010. Short-term payday lending is also up, according to Karen Petru of Federal Financial Analytics, who also says
something like 45 million Americans have less than $400 in a savings account or checking account.
So if those Americans had an unexpected expense and couldn't pay up, they'd be in trouble fast. Petru says this is a powder keg with a short fuse because these loans aren't from banks. They're from non-bank financial institutions like payday lenders. And more mortgages are from these institutions. Think Quicken Loans. Petru says they're not regulated like banks.
Capital, liquidity, the stress testing, the too big to fail cures, all of those things after the financial crisis are limited only to banks.
Now, talk to someone from Quicken Loans, and they'll tell you they still have to have liquidity, a cushion for emergencies, to get government guarantees for their loans. Bill Emerson is vice chairman of Quicken.
We have more capital than we could ever possibly need in a situation like that.
But there's no way to verify how ready these non-banks are for an emergency. Most are privately held and don't have to open their books. Richard Stanton is an economist at Berkeley.
They all claim that they maintain a huge capital buffer, but we really have no idea because we don't get to see their financial statements.
So we really don't know how well prepared they are to survive if that powder keg explodes. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
To be honest, I have never understood airline pricing structures.
Yeah, you and me both, pal. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 256 points today, 1%, 23,787. The NASDAQ lifted 73 points, about 1%, 68,696. The S&P 500 climbed 24 points, about 1%, 25,074. News that the ailing retail chain Sears, appearing before a bankruptcy judge today, has put off liquidation, at least for now. The retailer's largest shareholder, Eddie Lampert, has a takeover plan meant to keep the department store chain going. Sears Holdings boosted 30% today, 30%. We mentioned that report that found the greenhouse gas emissions spiked in the U.S. last year, CO2 specifically. So a look at some energy companies. How about that? ExxonMobil pumped up 0.7%. Chevron sputtered 0.4%. Chesapeake Energy up more than 3.3% today. Union Pacific Railroad announced the appointment of a new chief operating officer. Union Pacific chugged up 8.7% today. Canadian National Railway advanced 0.3%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.72%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Flint, Michigan first showed up in the headlines 4 or 5 years ago when the rest of the country learned about the lead in its water supply. Finding and replacing those lead pipes was a challenge. Lots of digging and lots of hoping until artificial intelligence came along. Alexis Madrigal wrote about the Flint cleanup and AI for The Atlantic. Alexis, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So this horrible thing happens in Flint. It comes to national prominence in 2014-ish. Lots of backing and forthing by the government and the state and everybody. And then, in a way, technology gets involved, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, some researchers found that they could identify which homes in Flint had lead pipes at a pretty high probability. And that allowed them to create like a pretty efficient program, even with a fairly ragtag group of volunteers, kind of starting in 2016 and moving into 2017.
Okay, how did they do it, first of all? What were the criteria, I guess, that they fed into this? I suppose it's an algorithm, right?
Yes, that's right. A series of them, actually. Well, you know, they have city records, but like most cities in the world, its records are incomplete and at times inaccurate. And so they were able to take those bad records and combine them with field testing to create this model, a machine learning model, so that as they continued to do more excavation and replace pipes out in Flint, they could feed that back into the model and increase its accuracy.
Okay, the key word there was excavation, because without this tool, because record keeping in Flint and a lot of other cities was so shoddy, they didn't actually know literally who had lead pipes. So they had to dig it up to figure it out until this tool came along. What kind of accuracy did the tool have?
You know, by the end of its run in late 2017, they were routinely hitting more than 80% of the time. So that meant when they excavated a home's pipes, it had lead or galvanized steel pipes and not copper.
And that obviously is a bad thing. But and then what happens, I guess, is the next question, because it goes downhill.
Yeah. And that's really the nature of the story that I wrote, is like, what happened? Because a major national contractor comes into play and the rate at which they hit plummets to 15%. So they're excavating more and more, but they're finding less lead. And it turns out that they kind of discarded the model and kind of went at the problem fresh. The city asked for some political things to be done, like excavating across the whole city. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't just follow the lead. They kind of followed both the politics and, you know, thousands of people in Flint still have lead service lines when if they had followed the previous method, they wouldn't.
Yeah, once you had politics involved. In a way, though, I mean, setting aside for just a second here the tragedy, really, of people still having lead who might not have to, you can sort of understand what the mayor of Flint did, right? Because her constituents were saying, hey, you dug up my neighbor's yard, but not mine, and I want to be taken care of.
That's right. I mean, I think, you know, if you are a parent in Flint, and they say, well, you know, it's unlikely your home has lead pipes, you say, well, why don't we make sure, right? And so what the mayor did was, in fact, like quite reasonable, I think, not just politically, but also, you know, socially, just as people. As we deploy more and more AI out into the world, I think we're going to see variations of this problem over and over, where people say, hey, look, we have this really great AI, and the person who's receiving that advice from the computer says, well, let's just make sure.
The cautionary tale here, of course, is not the thing everybody thinks it is, which is that AI is going to, you know, kill us all. It's that people are going to mess with AI and we're going to get worse results.
And they may not trust it. Right. The fundamental opaque nature of the way that a lot of these things work, and even if you try to explain it, how difficult it is to do so, means that people may just not trust these kinds of decision-making tools.
Alexis Madrigal is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Most recently, kind of a crazy story about artificial intelligence and the lead pipes in Flint, Michigan. Alexis, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Kai.
Maybe you flew someplace over the holidays, maybe vacation or to visit family, and maybe you paid more than you would have liked for your plane tickets. Or maybe you were pleasantly surprised to have gotten a good deal on your airfare, because really, when it comes to plane ticket pricing, it's all a mystery, right? Lucky for all of us, then, that we've got a whole segment of this program in which we explain the mysteries of economic life. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blade work.
Our query du jour comes from Jeff Sorensen. He's a web developer at Iowa State University in Ames. He says he flies out of Des Moines, Iowa's biggest airport, a lot, and he wants to know why it can cost less to fly Des Moines to some far-off place with a stop in between than it does just to fly the first leg of that trip itself. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what's going on.
I experienced a version of what Jeff Sorensen is talking about recently, flying from my hometown of Portland, Oregon, to Sarasota, Florida. I ended up flying into Tampa, renting a car, and driving an hour south to Sarasota because the airfare to Sarasota would have been nearly twice as high just to fly an extra 60 miles. And listener Jeff Sorensen has encountered even more crazy-seeming airfares. He found a one-way economy ticket from Des Moines to Seattle with a stop in Phoenix.
And it was $152. Same exact flight from Des Moines to Phoenix alone costs $162.
So the airline will fly him 1,400 miles farther for $10 less.
To be honest, I have never understood airline pricing structures.
Well, let's try to figure them out. First, when you travel by bus or train, the ticket typically costs more the longer the distance you're going. But with airlines, says industry analyst Henry Hardeveldt at Atmosphere Research,
distance really doesn't come into it.
It doesn't cost an airline twice as much to fly you twice as far, not even close. Once a plane is in the air at cruising altitude, the cost for additional fuel is pretty marginal. Seth Kaplan at Airline Weekly says these hard-to-fathom fares are common on airlines' own websites and also travel sites like Expedia.
There are times when you will pay more to fly from Portland to San Francisco than from Washington to Hong Kong.
Kaplan says a ticket's price at any given moment isn't based on the airline's cost to fly you from here to there, but on how many other people have already bought tickets to fly that route, how many seats are left, how long before the day of travel.
They look at empty airline seats when a flight takes off, kind of the way a bakery looks at bread at the end of the day. Spoilage, airlines call it. The airline's going to take something for that seat rather than get nothing at all for it.
In the end, what determines airline fares is a complicated balance of supply and demand, says Henry Hardeveldt, and how much competition there is between airlines to service that supply and demand on a moment-to-moment basis.
Airlines are the industry that pioneered revenue management, how to price each individual seat on each flight to extract the maximum economic value.
So let's go back to Jeff Sorensen's flights, where it would have cost less to fly from Des Moines to Seattle through Phoenix than it would to just fly to Phoenix. Hardeveldt says there could be a few reasons for that.
Des Moines to Seattle may actually have more competition on it. There may be multiple airlines that can take you there through different hubs, and it's possible there could be a budget airline.
But for a flight starting in Des Moines and terminating in Phoenix or some other hub airport, there may be only a couple airlines competing, so ticket prices will likely be higher. Hardeveldt says in the 1990s, several airlines actually tried to price their tickets based in part on the distance traveled.
It lasted about a nanosecond. A longer distance route that has more competition just has that much more battling going on between carriers for those customers. So it's best not to try to think logically when you're looking at airfares because you'll only drive yourself crazy.
Which is not recommended when preparing to fly. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
For this series to work, we need you all to tell us what you are wondering about economy-wise. There is a place you can do that. At marketplace.org. As final note on the way out. As of today, Amazon is the most valuable publicly traded company in the world by market capitalization, worth about $790 billion at the close this afternoon. You know, market caps are interesting, but really not too much more than that. And should you need a cautionary tale, go ahead. Google a six-month chart for the ticker symbol AAPL. I'll wait. All right, we're out. The Dow up 256 today, about 1%. The NASDAQ up 73, 1% there as well. S&P 500 climbed 24 points, about 1% on that index, too. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Heathcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.